Pay attention to me. So is everyone up to speed with the material from last week? Well, this chapter is a good example of why it is unwise and usually unsuccessful to put off thinking about this until one batch of studying before the test. It's just not, for most students, it's not possible. So you have to find some time each night to attack bits of this. But we were on slide 7, and in slide 7 we are looking at the notion of motor units. Now remember I was saying that skeletal muscle does not contract on its own. It does not have autorhythmicity. In other words, it has to be signaled, stimulated to contract by what's called a motor neuron, and that signal is in the form of a neurotransmitter that gets released by a motor neuron. So we have a whole muscle, which is a bundle of many, many myofibers, and we also have a motor nerve, and I should say that nerve is not a word that describes a cell. If you want to talk about a cell, you have to say nerve cell, which can also be called nerve fiber, which can also be called neuron. Those all mean the same thing. Just like a muscle fiber is a single cell, a myofiber and a muscle fiber and a muscle cell all mean the same thing. Nerve fiber, neuron mean the same thing. But when you use the word nerve by itself, that really is analogous to muscle. A nerve is a bundle of many, many neurons. All right? So, consider just one neuron of that nerve. And we're calling that motor neuron 1 in this slide. That single neuron has a long axon, that extends from the cell body. And a motor neuron's axon can branch any number of times. It can be highly branched or not so highly branched, but there are branches. So we call those branches collateral axons. And each branch of that single neuron innervates a separate myofiber in a muscle. All right, so each branch connects to its own muscle cell in the overall whole muscle. And what we define a motor unit as is a single neuron and all of the myofibers that it innervates or connects to. All right? So there's a motor unit for motor neuron number 1. That includes that neuron itself plus all the fibers, which in this case are shown in blue, that it innervates. And there's another motor unit in red corresponding to the other motor neuron. And every other motor neuron in that nerve will be associated with its own motor unit as well. So functionally speaking, the whole muscle is broken into motor units. And I say that's a functional breakdown because each motor unit can be activated separately. When a motor neuron fires, and when I say fires, that simply means when it creates and propagates or sends an action potential, every branch of that single neuron's axon, every collateral axon, in other words, is going to send an action potential. So you can't just send an action potential down one branch of an axon. If that axon fires, every branch fires. And therefore, every muscle cell that is innervated by that single motor neuron is going to be activated, and it's going to contract in response to that action potential. So, in other words, you can use a whole muscle, either a little bit or a lot, like I was saying last time. You can use your muscle for not very much force or much more force. But you do that by turning on a certain number of motor units. You don't have the ability to just turn on an individual muscle fiber. You have the smallest amount of force that you can develop in any given muscle is to just activate one motor unit and therefore contract however many myofibers are in that motor unit. But however many myofibers are in that motor unit is not a constant number. It depends on the muscle it's in. So for muscles that are very powerful, we tend to have large motor units, which means each motor neuron is connected to quite a big number of myofibers. And therefore, you have rough gradations of force that can be generated. But in very delicate muscles, like in your fingers, that allow you to do very precise manipulations, the motor units are small. So you can go up in very small steps in terms of the amount of force generated. Okay? Those are motor units. Let's go to 8 now and continue the anatomy aspect of how this stuff works. In the photograph, you can see this idea of motor units because those dark strands that you see are motor nerve fibers. Those are axons. They're actually not the entire neuron, but they're the endings of the neuron, or getting close to the ends, and the very ends of them are enlarged, just like you see in the cartoon version. This is a single collateral axon's ending that we're looking at, and it has an enlargement where it actually innervates the myofiber. So the place where innervation actually occurs, which is connection between the motor neuron and the myofiber, is called the neuromuscular junction, perfectly descriptively, right? So the cartoon, which is what you should focus on now, shows you a single neuromuscular junction. There are going to be neuromuscular junctions for all the other myofibers in that same motor unit. They're going to receive a different branch of that same motor neuron. Here we're looking at just one of the branches. Now, we say it's a connection between the motor neuron and the myofiber, but it really is not a direct connection. The two cells, the neuron and the myofiber, are not in direct contact. There is a small space between them. And we call this arrangement a synapse. So the neuromuscular junction features a synapse. And that little space that's between the two cells, neuron and muscle cell, is called the synaptic cleft. Now, the synaptic cleft is not very much space, but it is a space, and it's filled with fluid. Notice that that fluid is outside of both of the cells. It's outside of the neuron, and it's outside of the muscle cell. So the synaptic cleft, the fluid in that synaptic cleft, is extracellular fluid. And therefore, it's different in composition compared to the intracellular fluid in either the neuron or the myofiber. The enlargement at the very end of the axon, and we call this whole area the axon terminal, is called the synaptic knob, as you see labeled. And the synaptic knob has in it, pictured in green in this cartoon, a bunch of synaptic vesicles. Vesicles are little bags of membrane, right? Used for various purposes. They're what are created during endocytosis, like we talked about. But the synaptic vesicles in this case, the synaptic vesicles, which are specific examples of vesicles, contain in them already molecules of neurotransmitter. There are different kinds of neurotransmitters that the nervous system overall uses. But there's one neurotransmitter that is used in all of these neuromuscular junctions. So the interface between nervous system and skeletal muscles. And that specific neurotransmitter is acetylcholine, which can also be pronounced acetylcholine. That's what ACH stands for. Okay, when you see the ACH abbreviation, it means acetylcholine. Now, acetylcholine is contained in these synaptic vesicles and it's ready to be released. What process do you suppose it is that releases the acetylcholine if it's in vesicles? Exocytosis, correct. But exocytosis has to be triggered. Right now, these vesicles are not yet fused with the plasma membrane. When the vesicles fuse with the plasma membrane, that's when they open up and spill their contents out into the synaptic cleft. That's what exocytosis is. Okay? So, when a message is received at the end of the end of the axon, at the synaptic bulb, or knob, via acetylcholine will be exocytotically released into the synaptic cleft. What is it that actually tells the vesicles to release their contents? It's an earlier signal because this acetylcholine itself is a signal. It's going to be a signal to the muscle cell. But there has to be a signal to tell the synaptic vesicles to release their contents exocytotically. And that earlier signal is calcium ions. Now, calcium ions are an important signal for a lot of reasons, but there's two major reasons why it's an important signal in what we're looking at here. And what we're looking at here is called excitation-contraction coupling. Okay, the muscle cell is about to be excited, and in response to excitation, which is creation of an action potential, it's going to contract. That's excitation-contraction coupling. And so calcium is important in that, based on what I said last time. This hasn't happened yet in our scenario today. But calcium is responsible for moving, or changing the shape of the molecule that will drag tropomyosin out of the way. We've already mentioned that last time. That hasn't happened yet, but I'm just mentioning because that's another use of calcium as a signal. Well, calcium is used as a signal in the neuron, too. So, we have to assume now that this axon, which is part of a nerve, has been activated by your conscious determination to contract whatever muscle this is connected to. Okay, so you have the idea that you want to contract the muscle. That intention creates in that axon, way up in the where it's connected to the central nervous system, an action potential. So the neuron itself creates an action potential, and we're going to talk more about action potentials in a different chapter, but for now I need you to know that action potentials are changes in what are called membrane potentials. And when I use the phrase membrane potential, what I'm really referring to is a gradient. It's a gradient of charge. So any gradient is a difference from one place to another, right? A gradient of charge means an unequal distribution of charge on one side of the membrane versus the other. All cells, not just excitable cells, all cells have a membrane potential. But when that membrane potential, which is measured in a volts, it is a voltage, a potential is a voltage. When that changes in a little slice of membrane, a local place on the overall cell, not the whole cell at once, then that is an action potential, or when it changes a special way that we'll talk about more later. And that action potential then is going to cause a chain reaction. That first action potential is going to cause an action potential right next to it in the next little slice of membrane. And that's why we say that it travels down the length of the excitable cell. Okay, so you're determining that you're going to contract that muscle is what creates the action potential in the neuron, and then that action potential travels down the length of the axon from the spinal cord to wherever this muscle is, wherever this synaptic wherever the synaptic knob is on this particular muscle. And so that is the signal at first. We have to imagine now that the action potential has reached this synaptic knob. The action potential is a change in membrane potential, in voltage. Okay? So as a direct result of that, the change in voltage is such that it's going to open up what are called voltage-gated calcium ion channels embedded in the membrane of the synaptic knob. All right, so the synaptic knob is part of the plasma membrane of the neuron, which, by the way, also has the name neurolemma, just like the special name for the myofiber is sarcolemma. The plasma membrane of the myofiber is sarcolemma. The plasma membrane of the neuron is called the neurolemma. And so, just like any plasma membrane, that has a bunch of proteins embedded in it, right, for various reasons. At the synaptic knob, there are proteins embedded in that part of the plasma membrane that act as calcium ion channels, but they are gated ion channels, which means they're not always open. And specifically, they are examples of voltage-gated ion channels because what causes them to open is a certain voltage across the membrane. The action potential, once it finally reaches this synaptic knob, is that change in voltage that's necessary to open up these calcium channels. All right, so they've been closed up till now, before you thought about contracting the muscle. Now they open up in response to the neuron's action potential. Calcium ions, just like sodium ions, are in greater concentration in extracellular fluid than in intracellular fluid. Therefore, there is a gradient in place already with respect to calcium ions, and that gradient means they want to diffuse down that gradient. But remember that diffusion doesn't happen unless there is a way for diffusion to happen. Calcium ions are charged particles as ions, so they do not pass right through the phospholipid bilayer. They're locked out, basically, even though they want to go in where there's a smaller concentration of calcium ions. So once those voltage-gated calcium ion channels open up, because of the gradient, they diffuse in immediately. So it's this inward diffusion or this influx of calcium ions from the extracellular fluid into the synaptic knob in response to the action potential that causes the next signal, which is the release of acetylcholine from synaptic vesicles into the synaptic cleft. All right, everyone clear on that? That is the job of the neuron. Its job is now done, in a sense. And the action potential that was created way up at the cell body of the neuron, that action potential is now over. An action potential is an event. That is now over. Okay? There is going to be an action potential created in the muscle cell, but that's going to be a brand new action potential. So an action potential does not travel directly from the neuron to the muscle cell. And that's because this kind of synapse, the neuromuscular junction, is an example of what's called a chemical synapse as opposed to an electrical synapse. So just by comparison, in your heart, which is different kinds of muscle, right? Different tissue. There are electrical synapses between muscle cells. That's what those intercalated discs form. And so when the action potential travels down the length of one cardiac myofiber, it travels directly to the next one. That's not a chemical synapse, that's an electrical synapse. We don't have that here. We have a chemical synapse, which means the first action potential ends, and that causes the release of a chemical, which is why it's called a chemical synapse. And then the ultimate result of the release of that chemical is the creation of a brand new second action potential in the postsynaptic cell. Postsynaptic simply means the cell that's after the synapse, which in this case is the myofiber itself. Okay? So, up to now, we have activated the neuron and we have released acetylcholine. Notice the plasma membrane in the, just that local region of the synapse for the myofiber. It's part of the overall sarcolemma, but just this region in this picture below the synaptic knob, that little slice of sarcolemma is called the motor end plate. And notice that the motor end plate is elaborated or folded. It's not just a straight, smooth shot across the width. And whenever you have folds in a membrane, it's usually because there's trying to be more surface area. In this case, more surface area to hold more of these blue things in this picture, which notice are labeled as ACH receptors, acetylcholine receptors. Okay? Acetylcholine receptors, which are embedded in the sarcolemma at the motor end plate, are proteins, just like receptors in general are proteins. They serve as receptors because they have just the right shape to receive a certain kind of ligand. In this case, the ligand that they receive is the signal molecule itself, the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. Okay? And what is the general consequence of the binding of a ligand to a receptor? Conformational change in that protein itself. So ACH receptors, when they do receive and bind temporarily to acetylcholine molecules, will change shape. And this brings up their other function. Not, they don't just receive acetylcholine molecules. If that's all they did, the muscle would never know about it. You would just have a change in shape of a protein doing nothing. But these acetylcholine receptor molecules also serve as ion channels, and furthermore, gated ion channels. Now, they are ion channels for the passage of sodium ions and also potassium ions. But only when they're opened. So these are examples not of voltage-gated ion channels, because it's not a voltage that pops them open. It's the presence of the ligand which causes the shape change to the channel itself. So these are examples of ligand-gated ion channels. All right? By the way, these folds in the motor end plate that give the opportunity to have a lot more of these acetylcholine receptors than you would if it were just a smooth surface are called junctional folds. Now, I think I've talked enough about this slide. Let's go to 9. I'm not going to read this to you except for one row, the final one, and that's because it just wasn't shown in the previous slide. So I've already discussed all this, but this is for your information. The bottom row, though, acetylcholinesterase. That's what kind of thing? You should know that even by without cheating and reading this. It's an enzyme because its name ends in ASE, right? Acetylcholinesterase is an enzyme whose job it is to break an acetylcholine molecule down into the two parts that it's made out of. A complete acetylcholine molecule is part choline and part acetyl. And those two components, the acetyl group and the choline, are joined specifically by a kind of bond called an ester bond. And that's why the enzyme responsible for breaking that bond and therefore breaking acetylcholine into acetyl and choline separately is called acetylcholine esterase. Okay? The reason this is an important molecule in all of this is because if acetylcholine were released and just left out there, it would continue to bind to these ion channels, these ACH receptors, the blue things, which would mean those would be kept open. And as long as they're kept open, that's going to continue to allow the flow of ions, which serves as a signal to the muscle cell that you're trying to contract it. Well, if you only produce one action potential in the neuron, you want that information to be properly received by the muscle cell. If you only send one action potential, you want the muscle cell to respond with just one action potential of its own, not just continuous action potentials from then on, which it would if the acetylcholine were hanging around still. So very soon after acetylcholine is released, it's enzymatically split by acetylcholinesterase so that it no longer operates as a signal. It keeps the message intact, in other words. Now, if you want to continue to contract the muscle, you can do that. You do that by sending more and more action potentials through that neuron. And so you keep releasing acetylcholine, but the whole time you're breaking it down as soon as it's released. Okay? That wasn't listed in the picture. Now to 10. So we see the action potential reaching the synaptic knob in red on the top. That causes enough change in voltage to open up the voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the neurolemma of the synaptic knob. Because of the gradient that's already in place, there's an influx of calcium ions, and that influx of calcium ions is what directly causes the exocytotic release of acetylcholine into the synaptic cleft from the synaptic vesicles. The job of the neuron is now done. Acetylcholine doesn't have to travel very far because the synaptic cleft is so narrow, which is perfect for diffusion because diffusion works well only over short distances. Because of all those junctional folds, it's very easy to find an acetylcholine receptor for the acetylcholine to bind to. And these acetylcholine receptors are also known as voltage-gated sodium ion channels. Okay? Ligand-gated sodium ion channels. Okay, the ligand is the acetylcholine. When it binds, those channels open up. Now, a moment ago I told you that calcium and sodium are both more plentiful outside the cell than inside the cell. So when acetylcholine does open up these ligand-gated sodium ion channels, the gradient that's already in place for sodium ions means there's going to be an influx of sodium from the synaptic cleft, which is outside the cell, into the myofiber. All right. Now, what is the charge of sodium ions? Positive, and specifically plus one. So when these sodium ions come in, which you can see on step four here, that means you're bringing positives into the cell. That's why there's a change in voltage. Okay, at rest, in other words, before it was stimulated, the myofiber, just like any normal cell, will have a negative membrane potential. The voltage will be negative with respect to the inside of the cell. The inner surface of the plasma membrane will be negative compared to the outside. So when positives get coming in because of the diffusion of sodium ions, that means you're making the interior less negative. Okay, that is called a depolarizing potential. And that's happening simultaneously at a bunch of these acetylcholine receptors because there's so many of them embedded in those junctional folds of the motor end plate. Now, it just happens, nicely, that in response to a single neuronal action potential, there will be exocytotic release of enough acetylcholine molecules for those to bind to enough acetylcholine receptors to open up channels and allow enough influx of sodium ions into the myofiber that the change in membrane potential at the sarcolemma will bring it up to a special value it has to attain, a special voltage value called the threshold value or the threshold voltage. Okay? That's important because in order to get an action potential, which we haven't yet, you have to change the membrane potential from its value at rest, which is negative, up to a special value that is less negative, up here at threshold. Until you get it that high, you're not going to create an action potential, because action potentials are created in the sarcolemma by still other ion channels, which are proteins. Okay, so you have these ligand-gated sodium ion channels, but in the muscle cell you also have voltage-gated ion channels for sodium. And they don't open up unless you bring the voltage up to threshold. Well, the ligand-gated sodium ion channels opening up and allowing these positives in are what cause the membrane potential to get up to threshold, so that then these voltage-gated sodium ion channels can open up and create the action potential itself. Okay, so you need both kinds of channels, even though they're channels that allow the flow of sodium, the same ion, they're operating differently, and it's the voltage-gated sodium ion channels that are responsible for the action potential. The beginning of the action potential, I should say. Okay, because there's voltage-gated sodium and there's voltage-gated potassium ion channels as well. But that's the importance of getting up to threshold. Once you get up to threshold, you don't have to pass threshold. You might not, but as long as you touch threshold, that's going to open up these voltage-gated sodium ion channels and create that first action potential, which is then going to create the second one and so on all the way down the length of the myofiber. In both directions, simultaneously, from that synaptic cleft, which is where it's first created. Yeah?
Does that mean that the neuromuscular
junction is in the middle? Yes. Not necessarily exactly in the middle, but yeah, pretty close, because that's more efficient. You know, if you started at one end, it would take more time to travel the whole distance as if you start in the middle and have two simultaneously travel half that distance. Okay. Everyone on board so far? Okay, we can see these voltage regulated, this book calls them voltage regulated, other books call them voltage gated, ion channels working here. These didn't open up until enough sodium came in through the ligand gated ion channels to make the voltage high enough to open up these voltage gated ion channels. Okay? Once you have that, you have an action potential, and it's going to travel down the whole length of the myofiber. Now, the muscle has been excited at this point, but it has not at all contracted yet. So that's why we have to have excitation-contraction coupling. There has to be contraction in response to excitation, in other words. But so far, we've accomplished the action potential in the muscle in response to the action potential originally in the neuron via a chemical that was released intermediately. Okay, 11. Remember the T-tubules, the transverse tubules, which are really just pieces of sarcolemma but that fold into the interior of the cell. Well, when we say that an action potential propagates or moves from one end to the other of an excitable cell, you can imagine that just a single action potential moving along the membrane. That's not really what it is. It's really one action potential creates another one right beside it, but it looks like one is moving. Okay, so you can imagine it that way. Well, the transverse tubule is just a bend in that sarcolemma. So the action potential will travel down the T-tubule as well, every T-tubule, not just one, but we're looking at just one right here. So that's the yellow arrow. And remember that the action potential itself is a voltage. It's a voltage that's much more positive, much less negative, than what it was at rest before the action potential. And also remember how a triad is built. A triad is a single transverse tubule and a terminal cisterna on either side of it. Remember that the terminal cisternae are enlargements of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which is the membrane-bounded organelle inside the myofiber that's responsible for sequestering calcium ions. Okay? So let's back up just a microsecond, and before this action potential is actually reaching the terminal cisterna, the terminal cisternae have already been busy, like they continuously are, using ATP to power the pumping of calcium ions from the general cytosol through the membrane of the terminal cisternae into the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. So each terminal cisterna is, well, first of all, it's called a cistern or a cisterna because it's a tank. That's what a cistern is. So it's a tank of calcium ions. The reason they're sequestered in there, though, stockpiled in there, is because we've been using pumps, active transporters, which are proteins embedded in those membranes, continuously using ATP to bring the calcium from the general cytosol into the lumen of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, maintaining a very steep gradient and maintaining a very low concentration of calcium ions in the general cytosol. All right? Now, along with these continuously busy pumps that are embedded in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, you also have proteins in there operating as calcium ion channels. Very similar to the voltage-gated calcium ion channels that are in the synaptic knob of the neuron that we already talked about. Okay, but this is in the muscle, and actually inside the muscle, because this is not part of the plasma membrane. This is part of the sarcoplasmic reticulum's membrane. But they're still voltage-gated calcium ion channels, which means they will open up only if the voltage gets raised. Well, the voltage gets raised when the action potential travels down into the T-tubule and gets close enough to the membrane of the terminal cisterna, which is right by the T-tubule. So basically, the action potential in the T-tubule provides the zapping force in terms of voltage to open up voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the terminal cisternae's membranes. And when that happens, there's already a strong concentration gradient in place because of all that pumping that's been occurring. And so calcium ions spill out into the cytosol through these voltage-gated calcium ion channels. They come out of the terminal cisternae. They're just now in the general cytosol. And in the general cytosol is where you have the thick and thin filaments, the myofibers that we talked about last time. All right? So we're at 7 here. The release of the calcium ions, which are the white little spheres in this cartoon, they get released from the terminal cisterna. And now they are available in the general cytosol to bind to their binding sites on troponin. Now, what is troponin part of? Troponin is part of a thin filament. Remember that a thin filament is not pure actin. A thick filament is pure myosin. But a thin filament is F-actin made out of G-actin monomers strung together, plus troponin, plus tropomyosin. Okay, the troponin is hooked on permanently to an F-actin in one place and to a tropomyosin in another place. And that in that third place where it can bind to something is the binding site for calcium ions, which are normally not there. But now that they've been spilled out from the terminal cisterna, these calcium ions will bind to that binding site on troponin or troponin. That's going to cause a shape change of troponin. And when it bends because of that shape change, and since it's connected to tropomyosin, it's going to drag tropomyosin into a different position. Previously, tropomyosin, the green strand in this figure, has been covering several different active sites, which are the binding sites for myosin heads that you find on individual G-actin monomers of the red F-actin strand. Okay, each G-actin monomer has its own myosin head binding site or active site. But they've been covered up till now by the tropomyosin. The shape change of troponin that's caused by the binding of calcium ions drags that tropomyosin out of the way. And now the myosin head that's been right there the whole time but couldn't get to that active site can freely bind to the active site on G-actin. Okay? And that when that occurs, when there actually is binding between myosin head and an active site of G-actin, we call that a cross bridge. So the release of calcium ions from the terminal cisternae allow for cross-bridge formation. We've accomplished a little bit more, but still there isn't any contraction that's occurred yet. The muscle is still at the same length it was while it was at rest. 12. Now we can finally get to actual muscle contraction. This is shown as a cycle, because this will keep happening as a cycle as long as calcium remains bound to troponin, maintaining its shape such that tropomyosin will stay out of the way and allow all this to happen. Okay? But let's start at the top. Now, the myosin head here is shown to be moving. It's in its uncocked, more bent, and lighter, kind of whitish shape first. And what's not really shown explicitly there, but is true, is that when that uncocked myosin head is in that uncocked position, it's connected to an ATP molecule, which is an energy-carrying molecule. ATP is used for a lot of different things that require energy. In this case, in general, when ATP is used to power something that requires energy, the energy gets released when ATP gets hydrolyzed. It undergoes hydrolysis, which means it's going to be split apart in the presence of water. So an intact ATP molecule, adenosine triphosphate, is adenosine with three phosphates hooked onto it. When the last one of those three phosphates, which are daisy-chained together, gets removed from the rest, that's ATP hydrolysis. And that leaves ADP, adenosine diphosphate, with just two phosphates, plus a phosphate that's no longer connected to anything else. A phosphate on its own, since it contains just phosphorus and oxygen, is called inorganic phosphate, or P sub I. That's what the I stands for, inorganic. It's inorganic because it no longer is associated with a carbon-containing molecule, which adenosine is. Okay, so you spend ATP by breaking it down into ADP and inorganic phosphate. That's hydrolysis. The ATP that just moments ago was connected to this myosin head in the uncocked position gets hydrolyzed by the head itself. The head actually has enzymatic activity and hydrolyzes that ATP. The release of energy upon hydrolysis is what powers the cocking or the repositioning of this myosin head into its more energetic configuration, which is more spread out, like you see in darker purple at the top. Okay? So notice that ATP was not spent to create a cross bridge. Cross bridge hasn't formed yet. The myosin head has not yet bound to the active site of the G-actin. The energy of ATP was spent to cock the head of the myosin. Okay, now, assuming that everything that we've been talking about today has happened and tropomyosin is out of the way, this cocked myosin head will freely bind to the active site of the G-actin it's closest to. That is cross-bridge formation, and that happens for free once you cock the arm already. All right, so that's step 11 in this figure, but it's the rightmost part of this cycle. Now, just like the general case of a binding of a ligand to something else, when a myosin head binds to a G-actin, that's going to cause a shape change. In this case, the shape change is such that the cocked head of the myosin goes back to the uncocked position. All right, so it bends more like it was originally before the ATP was hydrolyzed. Not only that, but the ADP and the inorganic phosphate that were still stuck to it now get released. Importantly, though, when this bend occurs back to the uncocked position of the myosin head, while it's, in this case, connected to the G-actin, this is what actually causes the contraction. Because you have a thin filament and a thick filament running parallel to each other. When that shape change of the myosin head takes place, it drags the thin filament with respect to the thick filament, and they overlap more because of that, because the myosin head is connected to that thin filament. When it goes into its other position, it drags that thin filament along. That is what we call the power stroke. Okay, it's the power stroke, but notice ATP, it was not spent during that. ATP was spent earlier to cock the head of the myosin molecule so that it's invested in energy so that it can then undergo that power stroke. All right? So the ADP and the inorganic phosphate have already been released. We have a little bit of shortening because these thin filaments shown in red here have moved toward the M line, the center of the sarcomere. And since the other ends of these thin filaments are anchored to Z disks, that means the two Z disks have approached each other. The overall sarcomere has gotten a little bit shorter. That's the power stroke. So now we need ATP again. We're on the left part of the cycle. And a brand new ATP comes along, and if it's available, it will allow the breaking of the cross bridge. So ATP is required to actually break the cross bridge, not to form it. All right? And this allows the myosin to let go of the actin. This, by the way, explains rigor mortis. When a person is officially dead, that doesn't mean every cell in its body stops functioning. Right? It really just officially means that person's brain is dead. But the skeletal muscles still have a little bit of ATP available. So cross bridges can still be broken, and the muscles can therefore be loose. But when the ATP eventually runs out, because you're not, once you're dead, you're no longer replenishing that ATP, then whatever cross bridges had formed at that point can't be broken, because there's no fresh ATP to break those cross bridges. And therefore, your muscles are locked in that position at that time, whatever position they're in. That's rigor mortis. Eventually, that'll go away, but that's because eventually microorganisms start degrading you enough that you just collapse, basically. Okay, so the ATP breaks the cross bridge, and then now we can go back to the top. That's the ATP that I said was there originally, only it's a new ATP this time. And it's going to soon be hydrolyzed by the myosin head, which is going to re-cock it, and it's going to be ready for another round of cross-bridge formation and power stroking. So this happens over and over as long as calcium is present to keep bound to troponin to allow tropomyosin to be out of the way. This, we're looking at this from the point of view of one myosin head. And if the cross bridge is broken, then you would no longer have any interaction between myosin and actin myofilaments, right? And therefore, any progress you made would just be lost because the force you're trying to overcome in one direction would just slide them back from where they came from. But it's not just one myosin head. There are many, many myosin heads on that thick filament. And so there is never a point at which there is no myosin head hanging on. It's very analogous to a tug of war, right? To be successful at a tug of war, you don't just pull and then as far as you can and never let go, right? to actually win the tug of war, occasionally when you get some ground made, you have to let go, grab up farther on the rope, and then start pulling again. That's what this cycle is doing, really. Every time there's a cross bridge formation formed, it's farther on down the line of the actin. So they grab, move it a little bit, ungrab, cock their arm, and grab onto a different actin farther down the line so that you continue to have increasing overlap. And the reason you don't lose the ground is because while you're unbinding some heads, other heads are still connected. 13. Well, this is basically a summary of everything we've talked about when we get up to 17. So we've already talked about all of this. The action potential in the neuron causes opening of voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the synaptic bulb, or synaptic knob, I mean. The influx of calcium causes exocytotic release of acetylcholine. Acetylcholine diffuses across the synaptic cleft and binds to binding sites on acetylcholine receptors, which also are ligand-gated sodium ion channels. The influx of sodium into the myofiber changes the voltage until it reaches threshold, which is when the other kind of sodium ion channels, the voltage-gated sodium ion channels in the myofiber, take over, create the action potential, which then gets propagated in both directions down the myofiber from that synapse. Those action potentials travel down T-tubules, which gets the voltage close enough to the terminal cisternal membrane for voltage-gated calcium ion channels in those membranes to be opened. This is what allows the efflux of calcium from the terminal cisterna into the cytosol, where these calcium ions encounter troponin molecules, bind to them, changing their shape to drag tropomyosin out of the way. This allows for cross-bridge formation involving the ATP the way we just talked about. All right, so that brings us up to 17. Here you just see that this whole thing can be reversed. Okay, so it happened as a cycle like in last slide, only as long as calcium is still present. But now imagine that you're done intending to exert force in the muscle. That means you now caused the neuron to stop firing. You're no longer creating action potentials in the neuron. You therefore no longer are opening up these voltage-gated calcium ion channels in the synaptic knob. No more calcium comes in. That means no more vesicles get release their contents of acetylcholine. No more neurotransmitter is released, right? No more neurotransmitter released means the neurotransmitter that already has been released is now disintegrated because of acetylcholinesterase activity, and therefore the ligand-gated sodium ion channels in the motor end plate are no longer open. You're no longer allowing sodium into the myofiber, and therefore the resting membrane potential is going to be resumed. That's below threshold, so that does not allow for the opening of any of the voltage-gated sodium ion channels, and therefore no new action potentials are created. When no new action potentials are being sent down T-tubules, you're no longer opening up calcium ion channels in the terminal cisternae, and therefore the pumps that are right beside those channels take over. They never really stopped, but now they're the only things working, and the pumping of calcium ions is going to eliminate the calcium ions that were in the cytoplasm. Those are going to be pumped back into the terminal cisterna. So they're going to, once it's a low enough concentration, the calcium that was bound to troponin is just going to diffuse away from troponin, be unbound. It's going to take its original shape, which is going to drag tropomyosin back into the position of covering the active sites of G-actin. And therefore, even though those myosin heads want to bind to the G-actin, they're blocked. And there's no more cross-bridge formation. That's when whatever force you were trying to overcome, like lifting something, is going to just stretch the muscle back, decrease the overlap between the thin and thick filaments, and the sarcomeres get longer. All the sarcomeres along that myofiber will get longer, and therefore the whole muscle fiber gets longer. Yeah, go ahead.
So what happens when you contract a muscle and it stays contracted, but you're no longer exerting force on it?
Well, if you're no longer exerting force on it and it stays contracted, that means that there must not have been any force to overcome. So for instance, like I don't have to keep telling my biceps brachii right now to contract because the gravity of this forearm is keeping this bent. But if I do this without telling the muscle to contract, just that force of gravity is going to extend it. And that's what I was just saying in that last sentence, is that after you stop sending the signals, if there is some force that you were trying to overcome that would have been lengthening the muscle, if that's still present and you're no longer contracting to overcome it, it will be lengthened. Okay, it's just, but muscles don't lengthen on their own. They have to be stretched by something else.
So if you're no longer sending a nerve ender, but you still have like a force of gravity contracting your muscle, what's making that continue to cycle? You don't have the specific force anymore.
Well, the cycle stops. That's what I'm saying. When the cycle that we saw on the previous slide stops whenever this action potential stops. Because that's when the calcium pumps take over and make calcium scarce enough that it's not interacting with troponin.
So then what keeps the starting bridge from being shortened?
Nothing. That's what I'm saying. Once the cross bridges stop, then there's nothing holding the two myofiber types together, myofilament types together. So thin and thick filaments will be free to move in the other direction because whatever's trying to stretch the muscle will just bring them apart again. There's no grabbing on between myosin and actin anymore. That's what the cross bridges are.
So if your arm was just like this, how you had it?
Yeah.
So your muscle's still contracted, but you're not sending
it. It's not being contracted if I'm not actually contracting it. This is a relaxed muscle that doesn't have to do the work because gravity is just keeping it in that position.
I got you. Okay.
Okay. Slide 14 is a graph that is called a length tension graph. Although it's really tension versus length, because it's always y versus x on a graph. But anyway, the y-axis, the vertical axis, is graphing tension, amount of tension, which is the force that's being created in a muscle, versus the length of the sarcomeres. Now, you can think of it as an individual sarcomere, but if you think of it as this happening in a whole muscle, the sarcomeres are all basically the same length, because what happens in one is happening to all of them. And what you see here is that maximum tension, the maximum amount of force that you can generate in a muscle, occurs at an intermediate sarcomere length. And you don't get as much force if the sarcomere is too short or if it's too long. In other words, if the muscle is stretched out too far, you can't generate as much force. But if it's really bunched up already, you can't generate much force either. And that makes sense in terms of sarcomere architecture, as we've already described it. You see the sarcomere cartoons in each part of this graph. At the optimum middle, where you have the most force, what you have is a lot of opportunity for cross-bridge formation, because there's enough overlap between actin and myosin, even though they haven't connected yet. There's enough overlap in them so that a bunch of myosin heads will be able to make a cross bridge. And the more myosin heads that grab on, the more force there's going to be. Okay? Well, what if the sarcomere is too short? If it's too short, then there is so much overlap between thin and thick filaments that the thin filaments on opposite sides of the sarcomere start interfering with each other. You know, normally you would have a thick filament, thin filament overlap here with associated with one Z-disc, thin filament overlap here associated with this Z-disc, but the two thin filaments are not touching each other. When the sarcomere is very short, the thin filaments themselves start running into each other. That's what you see in that left cartoon above it, the overlap of the red lines. So that interferes with the process. And also helping that out, or hindering it in this case because it means less force, is the fact that the middle part of the thick filament doesn't have any heads anyway, right? So it doesn't make any sense. I mean, it doesn't matter whether there's actin there or not because there's no myosin heads to grab onto it at that point. If it's too long, on the other hand, then you just don't have enough overlap to begin with. And so, and therefore, there's just a small population of myosin heads that can do any good, only the ones that are near that little bit of overlap of the thin filaments. Once you increase the overlap, though, you're going to get the sarcomere back to a medium length where you're going to have much more overlap. And you can prove this to yourself, that this actually does occur, by using a barbell, for instance. If you use a barbell and play around with different weights so that you are lifting the maximum amount you can with a fully outstretched elbow, so you'll get to a weight where you can just barely lift it. Well, you can put a little bit more weight on, and if you start with a half-bent elbow, you can overcome that maximum because you're starting out with your sarcomeres at an intermediate length, and therefore they already have a lot more overlap and you can generate more tension. Okay, now to 15. Another graph. This one is tension versus time, though. So a totally different type of graph. And what we see here are three phases that occur in response to excitation of a muscle cell. So there is a so-called, well, first of all, notice that the red line is muscle tension, and it's just a constant until the muscle gets stimulated. Okay? The reason that it's not at zero, by the way, is because, well, if you think about this as a whole muscle, it's not at zero because you have what is called muscle tone. And by muscle tone, I'm talking about a different thing compared to what health magazines call it. Muscle tone refers to a continuous low level of stimulation in the muscle. So there's always going to be some myofibers that are being stimulated, kind of taking up slack and keeping that muscle ready. Your muscle is, unless you're drugged, your muscle's never really entirely at rest. There are always going to be some myofibers pulling. And by the way, to keep them from fatiguing, you don't notice this, but when you're at rest, when your whole muscle is what you call at rest, some of them will be pulling for a while, then they'll rest, and other ones will be pulling, so you maintain a little bit of muscle tone. Okay? But it's a low constant level here before you actually make the intention to lift something or something, to contract the muscle. But then we have the time of stimulation. So the time of stimulation has a width to it. This isn't just a point in time, this is a range in time. It has a duration. Because all those things that took me about 45 minutes to explain have to occur. It only takes those milliseconds to happen, but it's milliseconds, it's not zero time, right? So it takes time for the action potential to travel down the neuron, for all the other things to happen, before you ever start having any increase in the overlap between the filaments. And that's followed by the latent period, which also doesn't feature any tension yet, because the latent period, not only do you have the stuff in the muscle happening, right, the time of stimulation, that occurs in the neuron and the synaptic cleft. The latent period involves all the stuff that's happening in the muscle in response to that, but before you actually get contraction. And that involves not only the action potential traveling down the myofiber and the release of the calcium and so on, but it also, even once you start having cross-bridge formation forming, you don't immediately have contraction because you have to overcome... You have to take up some slack in the sarcomere, basically, before you actually start pulling. Just like if you have a little bit of slack in a chain that you're pulling on, you have to exert some force just to take up that slack before whatever it's connected to starts moving. All right. But once those slack elements are taken up, or the slack in those elements is taken up, then you start having muscle tension being developed, and that's the beginning of the contraction phase. Okay. Aptly named. Now the contraction phase then ends at the peak, which is when everything gets reversed because you have ceased sending neuronal action potentials to that motor unit, and therefore that's called the relaxation phase. doesn't just immediately drop back down to where it was. It takes some time for that to happen. But it's pretty straightforward terminology. Now to 16. In this slide, notice that the little end view of these nerves, or this nerve, I should say, is being pictured between the graphs. Now it says proportion of nerve fibers excited, but that is one nerve that's being represented. That circle is one nerve, right? Remember I said a nerve contains multiple neurons. Each little circle in the big circle is a neuron or a nerve fiber. And so the proportion of nerve fibers that are excited means what fraction of that total number of neurons in that overall nerve are propagating action potentials at the moment or are firing. That's what that refers to. Okay, well, this has to do with motor units again. Remember that each individual neuron in that nerve is the master of one motor unit. It's a member of that motor unit too. Right? It's the motor neuron and all of the myofibers that it innervates makes up that one motor unit. So when a single neuron fires, every muscle cell in that corresponding muscle motor unit contracts. And therefore, that generates a certain amount of tension. Not the maximum amount of tension that the whole muscle can generate, because that's just one of several motor units in that overall muscle. Now, the top part shows you stimulus voltage. This means stimulus voltage. This is an artificial situation. So normally, you stimulate your neurons by intending to do so from higher up in your brain. But you can also artificially stimulate neurons just with voltage. If you put electrical conductors on an actual nerve, which is a bundle of neurons, depending on the strength of that voltage, you can cause one or more of the neurons in that nerve to create action potentials. That's what's happening here artificially. And until you get to a certain minimum threshold of a voltage that you're applying to the nerve, you're not even bringing even one of those neurons up to their own threshold to create an action potential. That's why the first couple, there are no red neurons in this nerve because you're not even causing any of them to create an action potential. And therefore, when they don't create an action potential, the muscle has no idea anything's happening because it's not receiving any message from those neurons. Okay? And that's why you have no tension being developed in the muscle on the bottom graph. But once you have enough of a stimulus artificially on the nerve to bring at least one neuron to its threshold potential and therefore create its own action potential, then that action potential is going to be just as strong as any other action potential. We say that they are all or none. Either they happen or they don't. And when they do happen, all action potentials are the same magnitude. So there aren't strong and weak action potentials. You either have an action potential or you don't. They're all equal. All right. So you bring just the minimum stimulus, the threshold stimulus in the nerve, would be one that just invokes or creates an action potential in one neuron in that bundle. But that one neuron, remember, is going to be innervating several different myofibers. So this minimum tension that you're going to be creating in the muscle, that's not because of one myofiber contracting. It's because of however many myofibers are in that one motor neuron's motor unit are contracting. But it's the minimum amount of muscle tension in that particular muscle that you can create. Like I said, if it's a big muscle, you'll have big motor units, so it will be a bigger minimum tension compared to one in a small muscle with precise movements that have smaller motor units. Because you're with smaller motor units, you're just bringing in the contraction of a smaller number of myofibers. We call this recruitment or motor unit recruitment. The idea here is that we are recruiting additional motor units as we fire more and more of the neurons in the overall nerve. So this is an artificial situation, but what's happening in your body naturally is that if you realize after first trying that what you thought wasn't very heavy is heavier than it looked, you're going to intend with greater intention to lift that. What you're really doing is recruiting more motor units because you're causing more neurons in that motor nerve to fire, which is going to cause more motor units to be recruited in the muscle cell, or in the whole muscle. And therefore you have more and more whole muscle contraction. So this bottom graph, importantly, is not a single muscle cell. This is a whole muscle. A single muscle cell will have a certain amount of contraction or none, because it's either going to contract or not, right? That's a muscle twitch. Here you have whole muscle because you're recruiting more and more motor units. Now to 17. More graphs to look at. Now we're looking at muscle tension versus frequency of stimulus. And the whole concept here is called temporal summation. Now, what does temporal mean? In time. Summation refers to adding together, right? Well, because of that graph that we showed that has the contraction phase and the relaxation phase, a muscle, while it is relaxing, can still be more contracted than it was before it contracted, right? Because it hasn't gotten back all the way to the where it was originally. And if, before it gets all the way back down to where it was originally, another stimulus comes along and causes it to contract again, it will be starting at a shorter length anyway. So that same amount of contraction is going to shorten it even more. This is summation. The only way that can happen, though, is if you stimulate the muscle multiple times with a high enough frequency. The frequency refers to how often it's happened, how frequently it happens. If it happens often enough at a high enough frequency, that means they're spaced together closely, the events, and you don't give the muscle time to go all the way back to being relaxed. Therefore, each next time you stimulate it, it's going to go from where it was at that point. It's going to add up. So we see this at a low stimulus frequency. Each blip on the red line is one action potential in the neuron. That's going to correspond in the graph to just one twitch, which is one contraction event in a single muscle cell. Okay? Or in a whole muscle. You could think of it as a whole muscle as well. But the low frequency means the muscle is going to have enough time to fully recover from that first contraction, and therefore when the second one comes along, it's just like the first one. You're starting from zero. But if you space them out not as far and increase the stimulus frequency, then it doesn't have time to fully recover, and it can start building up. That's temporal summation. All right? Now, tetanus, which is shown on the second two graphs here, is the condition in which all the fibers, myofibers, are maximally contracted. So the muscle basically is locked into its maximum. And you can get that artificially by giving it electricity at a high frequency. You can, you know, this is what locks people up into tetanus if they get shocked, for instance. You're sending a very high frequency of stimuli, and that just keeps it right at the maximum. Physiologically, though, and that's what's the artificial one is this unnatural one. Physiologically, though, that doesn't happen. You can get to physiological tetanus or tetany simply by exerting as hard as you can, but you can't keep it there very long because it's very tiring, right? But that's what's happening, temporal summation. And that will end it for today.